Okay, so as Kay said, I'm here today to discuss the evidence-based analysis process used to support the development of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. I am to start off by saying that I have no relationships to disclose regarding personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation in the past 12 months. Okay, so today's outline, I will begin by giving you a brief overview of the purpose and history of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, and then I will outline the development process of the guidelines, highlighting the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee and the evidence-based review methodology used to support their recommendations. This first presentation will really describe the process aspect, how the dietary guidelines are developed, specifically how the 2010 dietary guidelines were developed. The next presentation that I will do will deal more with what the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee recommended. The actual federal policy, the Dietary Guidelines for Americans 2010, are not yet released. So I will report what the advisory committee reported, but I can't say definitively what the federal policy will say. We use the report as the basis for the policy, but again, it's not out yet. Oh, and then Kay, as she said, we'll talk about the communication aspect. So we kind of are dealing with, I would say, like I deal with the science chunk of it, and then we'll talk more about what the recommendations are, and she really talks about the fun stuff. Okay, so as Kay said, what are the dietary guidelines? They are the federal nutrition policy that are established jointly by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services. As Kay said, they provide nutrition advice for Americans ages 2 years and older to help promote health and prevent chronic disease. The guidelines form the basis for nutrition policy and federal food, education, and information programs, such as the school lunch program. And all messages and materials that are produced throughout the federal government have to support messages that or have to support the guidelines so that the government speaks with one nutrition voice. The guidelines are also used by many educators, and hopefully many of you here have used them, as a basis for nutrition education. The guidelines were first published in 1980, and by law, they are reviewed, updated if necessary, and published at least every 5 years. As Kay said, they provide science-based or evidence-based recommendations that represent the preponderance of evidence related to nutrition and health. Okay, this is a snapshot of the 6 editions of the Dietary Guidelines that have been published to date. As I said, the 2010 edition is coming soon. Some recommendations have been provided throughout the time from 1980 to 2005, such as we consistently recommend that individuals consume a variety of foods. There have been consistent messages about, you know, reducing intakes of sugar, sodium, different things like that. However, there also has been change over time. So, for example, in 1995, we first introduced the concept, or not the concept of physical activity, but physical activity recommendations. Trans fats first came in 2000. So, over time, there has been a little bit of evolution. I will say that the 2010 advisory committee did address topics that have never been looked at before by an advisory committee. So we do expect some kind of new things to come out in 2010. Okay, so how are the dietary guidelines developed? The first step in the process was the appointment of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, or the DGAC, as I'll say probably a lot. They serve as a federal advisory committee. This committee is composed of representatives outside of the federal government who are nominated by individuals, organizations. Anyone in the public can submit a nomination. Some people nominate themselves, so it's really broad open. The nominations are reviewed, and the committee members are appointed by the secretaries of USDA and HHS. And this process occurred in the summer of 2008. So over the course of many months, 20 months to be specific in this case, the DGAC deliberated about the current state of nutrition science during subcommittee meetings and at 6 public meetings. 3 of those publics were actually held by a webinar this time. And actually those archives are still available on our website that, you know, if you're so inclined, you can go and view them in their entirety. The end product of the DGAC work was the report of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee on the Dietary Guidelines for Americans 2010. This is a 600-plus page report. That is a compilation and integration of the committee's conclusions and recommendations about nutrition and health that the committee submitted to the secretaries of USDA and HHS in June of this year. Federal staff are now using the DGAC report to develop the seventh edition of the dietary guidelines, and this is, as I said, the actual policy document. As I've already mentioned, I'll talk a lot about kind of what was in the report. Can't say specifically what will be in the policy document. In the future, the policy document is implemented through federal programs, as I said, through school lunch and through nutrition education programs. Okay, the 2010 DGAC was composed of a 13-member panel whose names you can see there on the right. This panel brought together a broad range of expertise. The backgrounds of the 13 members covered a wide array of topics that are pertinent to the dietary guidelines. Dr. Linda Van Horn served as the chair. Dr. Naomi Fukugawa was the co-chair. The committee members formed several content-related subcommittees, which you can see there in the middle. And they were chaired by experts in that particular area. Four panel members at the bottom did not chair a subcommittee, but contributed their related expertise within various subcommittees. Of the 13-member panel, two were members of the 2005 DGAC, and they actually came back for another round. Those were Drs. Zave Pissonnier and Dr. Larry Apple. One of the members, Dr. Mim Nelson, actually served in the 2008 Physical Activity Guidelines Advisory Committee. Several members have served on IOM panels, and they're all distinguished scientists and researchers. Okay, so after the DGAC was appointed, they met and began talking about topics that would be pertinent to the 2010 dietary guidelines. And they started by asking questions, and they really kept asking questions. In the end, they asked about 150 questions related to foods and food groups, nutrients, dietary behaviors, the food environment, various outcomes, including body weight, overweight and obesity, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and various intermediate outcomes such as LDL cholesterol. Examples of the questions that they considered include things like, what is the association between eating out and body weight, and what are the effects of sodium intake on blood pressure in children and adults? Okay, so in the I do want to add that kind of one thing that's different in 2010 is the committee really felt like that the greatest public health concern right now is is overweight and obesity. And so their policy document really, Linda Van Horn, I don't know how many times she said it, you know, we're looking through a lens of overweight and obesity. And so that really is a difference in 2010 compared to some of the other previous advisory committees and other previous dietary guidelines. So overweight and obesity is kind of a continuous trend throughout the policy document, throughout the report. Okay, so they have all these questions. How did they go about answering them? Well, about two-thirds of the questions were answered using the USDA's Nutrition Evidence Library. I will discuss this process in the next several slides. However, they also had a number of other means to address their questions. Some questions were answered using food pattern modeling. So food pattern modeling is an approach that uses the USDA food patterns to test the feasibility of potential recommendations. So for example, they might have had a question of, you know, can nutrient needs be met if seafood intake was increased to 8 ounces per week? And the answer to that, you could do the modeling analyses and determine, yes, if you increase seafood intake to 8 ounces per week, you can meet other nutrient needs. So that was the purpose of the modeling component. The committee also relied on data analyses, particularly from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, or NHANES. National survey data allowed the committee to answer questions such as what nutrients are underconsumed and overconsumed by the general public. So with this data, the committee could really tailor what they were talking about. They could really focus on those things that are of particular concern to what Americans are eating right now. And then finally, the committee leveraged existing authoritative reviews and reports to address topics when they were available. So for example, the committee moved forward the recommendations that are in the 2008 Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans, which are from HHS. And they also used a variety of IOM reports. They relied heavily on the DRIs, the dietary reference intakes. So they wanted to, you know, promote those authoritative reports, but not duplicate efforts. So they moved a lot of those things forward. So I do want to note that it was really nice. I think it really was a benefit to the review that they kind of had all these different ways to address some of the topics. It allowed them to look at some things in a variety of different angles. So for example, one of the things that I'll talk about today is seafood. They were able to ask a true evidence-based analysis question about seafood, so using the NEL process. So they were able to look at the benefits that way. They also looked at a systematic review that was already out there that was done by IOM. That was Seafood Choices in 2007 that talked a lot about risks of seafood intake. They did food pattern modeling to say, okay, well, can we even, you know, there might be benefits to seafood intake, but can we have people increase their seafood intake and still meet other needs? And then we also were able to do data analyses to say, okay, this is where current seafood intake is, and this is how much it would need to increase to meet kind of this new recommendation. So we were able to look at things in a number of different ways, which I think strengthened the review process. Okay, so as I mentioned, most questions were answered using the Nutrition Evidence Library, or NEL. The NEL was created at USDA to conduct systematic reviews to inform federal nutrition policy and programs. Over the past few decades, evidence-based systematic reviews have replaced expert opinion as the preferred basis for health-related treatment guidelines and policy. There is actually a reason as to why the NEL was developed. It ensures compliance with the Data Quality Act of 2001, which mandates that federal agencies ensure the quality, objectivity, and integrity of the information used to form federal guidance, so that the guidance is actually based on a body of evidence and not a group just convening and providing that recommendation. The NEL uses a systematic process that is rigorous, transparent, and ultimately the purpose is to minimize bias. Okay, so in this slide, I'm just going to give you kind of a skeleton outline of what this process is. The next couple of slides, I'll give you a specific example of how this process was used for the dietary guidelines. The first step, I will also add that the methodologies for, if you're not familiar, you have no idea what I'm talking about when I say evidence-based or systematic review methodology, this is becoming more commonly used. Similar processes are used in the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, or ARC, also used for the USPSTF, as well as Cochrane and the American Dietetic Association. So a lot of the methodology, I mean, there are some things that differ between the systems, but the basic concept of all of them are the same. So, the first piece of this is to ask questions, and as I said, they ask a lot of them. A lot of people consider this step to be the most important step. You know, if you don't ask a question about a topic, you're not going to address it. So, question development is really a hot topic. So they have to ask a question that's targeted enough to be answerable. I mean, it can't be too broad, but it also isn't too specific. We use a PICO system that is helps to make the question targeted so you know what population they're interested in, what kind of intervention and comparator, and what outcomes they're looking at. So that's the first step in the process. And the next step, this is where the real systematic part of it begins. In this next step, they develop, with the help of NEL staff, a search and sort plan. So in this particular step, they determine inclusion and exclusion criteria. So this is before anything even begins. They start talking about, okay, in this topic area, what research, you know, are there criteria that we need to use to determine what studies we're going to consider in this review? In the case of the dietary guidelines, for example, they didn't use any animal studies, so that would have been an exclusion criteria that was used throughout. So before we even begin, we talk about what types of study they want to look at. We also define the search strategy. As I'll talk about, all of this is provided on our website, but it's very, you know, we talk about the date range they want to include, the databases to consider, search terms, things like that. Okay, then in the next step, we have a research librarian that conducted the searches. There's kind of a process for determining, identifying the studies that meet the criteria for the review. So the search is done, and then studies that don't meet the inclusion and exclusion criteria are excluded, and we end up with a list of included studies. Then we extract relevant evidence from the studies, which makes sense. And an important part of a systematic review process is to evaluate the methodological rigor of each study, which I know that's really thrilling, but you look at the quality of each study so that it's not, bean counting. You actually look at the study design, the validity, things like that. And in our case, studies were rated as positive, negative, or neutral quality. They then synthesize the body of evidence, and then they answer the question. We also call this developing a conclusion statement, and then they state the strength of the evidence to support the conclusion. So the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee specifically used the language of there is strong evidence, moderate evidence, or limited evidence. In many cases, the committee also described research needs for that particular area. So this may be of interest to some of you that the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee did identify over 80 research recommendations that can be found in their report. Okay, so I'll just quickly run through an example because I know if you've never heard of that, it's not exactly intuitive what I'm talking about. One of the questions, as I mentioned, they talked about some topics in the dietary guidelines process that hadn't been considered before. And one of the things they looked at more this time were dietary behaviors. And this is one of those behaviors. They asked, what is the relationship between self-diet monitoring and body weight in adults? So this would be, writing down what you eat, keeping track of calorie content, things like that. So they developed a specific search and sort plan. In this case, they looked at literature in the from 2000 to present, where this body of evidence has really expanded. The committee overall really varied at how much the time frame they looked at. Some had, looked at all literature of all time. Some of them, it was more targeted to a certain period. As I said, they had particular search terms they identified and criteria for both inclusion and exclusion of articles. For example, they only looked at studies that had less than a 20% dropout rate. In this case, as I mentioned already, they didn't look at animal studies. However, this isn't a big, we didn't have any of those in this search of writing down what you eat, but we don't have a lot of rats that do that, but that was a common criteria that they used. I will also note that they, because it is a Dietary Guidelines for Americans and it's a general public, they stay away from medical nutrition therapy. So individuals who were diagnosed with the disease, and that was the only participants in the study, were typically excluded. Okay, so in this case, they pulled up 69 articles. Of those, some of the studies were excluded just based on a title search. So if you've ever done a search on PubMed, a lot of stuff comes up. And so you can pretty much clear out some things just by looking at the title. In this case, 33 studies went through an abstract review, sometimes a full article review. And a total of 7 articles actually met all of their inclusion criteria. 26 articles were excluded. And the next step, information on self-monitoring and body weight was extracted from the included studies. And as I mentioned, the methodological rigor of each study was evaluated using predetermined criteria. So in this particular question, they ended up with 6 randomized controlled trials, which are generally considered to be the gold standard. 3 of them had positive quality, 3 neutral quality. One was a non-randomized controlled trial that had positive quality. For all of the questions that the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee considered, when they were looking at the body of evidence, they considered 5 domains. The first was the quality of the studies included. Were they randomized controlled trials? Were they cross-sectional studies? As well as their quality rating. The consistency, did they consistently find the same things? Or did the studies find different things? If they found different things, could you describe why? The quantity, quantity of studies as well as quantity of the participants in the study. The impact, you may have seen a difference, but was it of any clinical significance? And then the generalizability. So does this just apply to a little segment of the population, or is this something that is appropriate for general nutrition guidance? So those are the 5 domains used throughout the process. When they looked at all the evidence, they found that they felt that there was strong evidence that shows that for adults who need or desire to lose weight or who are maintaining body weight following weight loss, self-monitoring of food intake improves outcomes. And this led to their recommendation that adults are encouraged to self-monitor food intake to improve outcomes when actively losing weight or maintaining body weight following weight loss. So I know this example is kind of very, you know, too specifics in the weeds, I guess you could say, but the point is that it is a rigorous, it's a systematic process, and this is what they used for about 130 questions. I will also add that over the course of their review process, they looked at over 1,000 articles that are summarized in the report. Okay, so in kind of closing to this piece of the presentation, I just want to note that one of the things that I think is really unique about the 2010 process is the transparency and availability of the information that the committee considered. You can find all of the information that you probably ever wanted to know about their reviews at nutritionevidencelibrary.com. If you go to this webpage, this is the home page, and there's a tab for the dietary guidelines, the DGAC. You can go there and find all of the committee's reviews that they did using this process. You can look at the content areas, which I'll talk about more in the next part of this presentation. You can look at the A to Z index for topics. You can also search for topics. You will find your topic of interest if it's in there. Once you find the question, and this is the question we just discussed, which is what is the relationship between self-monitoring and body weight, you can go here and find the question, the conclusion, the grade, a summary of the evidence that was prepared by the committee, as well as a description of the search strategy. And this includes not only, you know, the search and sort plans and things like that, but also identifies the studies that they included and identify the studies they excluded and why they were excluded. So the point is that it's the purpose is to be pretty transparent. Okay, also just as additional information, everything dietary guidelines can be found at dietaryguidelines.gov, and this will be where the policy document is posted. This includes the DGAC report, which you can see, you can look at each section of the report on the website. We will be publishing copies of it, but they're not published yet. As I mentioned, it's like 600 pages, so if you're so inclined, you could have a copy. And then all other related materials about the dietary guidelines are posted here as well. As I mentioned, we had some meetings that were offered by webinar, and you can look at the archives of those meetings here.